And also, if you maybe I speak about speculative things in progress, if you don't mind, I hope. So the motivations is a bit still trying to understand basically if edge modes exist. So presumably, I think they exist, but then one should maybe be more specific about where they actually exist and in which form. So how to describe them? What do they actually mean? And so where, at infinity or at finite distance, and how to describe them? And also what for? What to do with them? And I think it's important because they appear in many places. It seems that they appear everywhere, but always in kind of a disguise and in a very different language. And so, for example, in all these discussions about the holography, for example, and boundary dynamics, secretly one thinks that it has to do with, you know, the dynamics of whatever is not really pure gauge, but acquires the dynamics on the boundary of the system, usually some holographic boundary. Also, these edge modes have also seemed to play a role in discussions of entropy, and especially entanglement entropy. And presumably, they're also very important for quantum gravity, so quantization of gravity. If we do what we do in loop quantum gravity, for example, look at small subsystems and glue them together, it's important to understand the structure of the edge modes of the theory. And so there are also many approaches. And by many approaches, I mean, for example, so typically since these edge modes exist and all these approaches to boundary dynamics and holography, usually people don't really introduce fields by hand. Rather, for example, they go on shell, solve the equations of motion, and then part of the data that would be gauged then becomes dynamical. But recently, there was also a tendency to actually a bit extend the phase space to get a more kind of hands-on control on these edge modes. So to actually introduce fields, so one can either not introduce fields or introduce fields, and this is also a bit confusing to me. And also there's very interesting work by, so initiated by Aldo Riello, Enrique Gomez, and also Florian Hopfmüller, where they also make use of kind of extra structure in field space to describe these edge modes and how to properly handle gauge transformations on systems with boundaries. And so here, what I would like to just I want to take a bit of a glimpse and take some examples of things that I find interesting. And the first thing is to discuss first order theories, and especially gravity, and then boundary dynamics in transiments and Maxwell. And so then still as a motivation of why I think it's maybe important to understand properly first order theories, for example, gravity. I just talk about first order Maxwell again. And I repeat an argument that we kind of came up with last year, but which I think makes the point that one should maybe try to understand if when we take two equivalent theories, if they seem to be equivalent on shell, maybe they're equivalent in the bulk, but they're not equivalent at the boundary. For example, the charges may not be different, may be different, and the boundary symmetries may be different. And maybe it's important to precisely keep track of this difference, which is only visible at the boundary. And so in the context of Maxwell, I was interested in this because we also learned recently, mostly from the work of Strominger, that something which looks a lot like these edge modes, except that they are called soft modes, they play a very important role in the infrared structure of theories of massless theories. So for example, a QED and gravity. And what is shown in the work by Strominger and also Campiglia and Lada is that one already sees this in the Weinberg soft theorem, is that the soft theorem implies conservation of actually two types of charges in Maxwell theory. So soft electric charges, but also magnetic charges. So we have conservation of both electric and magnetic charges. And another thing which is a bit surprising is that one can also, as Campiglia did with Sebastian Misera and maybe a third author, which whom I forget, one can also look at the soft theorem for a massless scalar field. And then the soft theorem also holds, but by the triangular equivalence of Strominger, then one learns that to these conserved soft charges, one can assign, so there is some set of conserved quantity, and if we try to give a gauge interpretation to these conserved quantities, this is obviously not present in the original scalar field theory because it's not a gauge theory, but we can reveal this conserved quantity by actually dualizing the initial scalar field and writing it as a p-form theory. So there is also soft theorem for scalars. So the question was, how do we know in general if there are kind of, in a sense, hidden charges in a theory? If you think we have described all the charges of the theory, namely the charges which have actually a canonical generator in the bulk, how do we know that we are not missing some of the charges? Typically in electromagnetism, electric charge we know because it has a generator in the bulk, but we usually don't talk about the magnetic charge. And also this discussion about the scalars. So are there, so hidden is not the proper word, but charges which can be revealed through some procedure, and I want to ask whether, what could be this procedure? And so typically in electromagnetism, this question was answered by, so I know of two proposals to do this in electromagnetism. One of them is by Laurent and Daniele, or Friedel and Pranzetti. And to do this, they actually implement the electromagnetic duality, describe these magnetic charges, but on a phase space which is already an extension of the phase space of Maxwell theory, namely a phase space which is an extension, so following the procedure of Laurent and William, which introduces, in a sense, electric edge modes. And then once you have these electric edge modes, you can implement this duality and describe the magnetic charges. Then the other approach that I know is work by a group from Iran, so Hossein Zadeh, Siraj, and Sheikh Jabari. And what they propose instead is to describe these magnetic charges and their commutator with the electric charges by using some formulation of Maxwell theory, which is kind of an extension of the theory, which is called duality symmetric. So this is a big extension of Maxwell theory where you consider two gauge fields, and the Lagrangian, you take it to be basically star F wedge F plus star G wedge G. And then you impose a constraint which identifies G with star F. And then once you impose the constraint, so once you go on shell, this becomes equivalent to Maxwell. But what they claim is that even though it's equivalent on shell, at the boundary, you have a representation of the magnetic charges, and they can extract the algebra of the magnetic and electric charges, and they find the same result as Laurent and Daniele, and also the same result which was the original motivation, namely the result of Strominger, which is that these charges, they form a current algebra. So the motivation here was to kind of try to reproduce this result and also try to explain this from, so the idea is to reproduce this from a first order formulation. And why first order? Because typically this type of dualities, so electromagnetic duality in Maxwell, and also the duality which enables you to write in D dimensions a scalar field as a gauge theory for a D minus two form, these are dualities which typically exchange the equations of motion and the Bianchi identity. And in both examples here, the equations of motion and the Bianchi identity, they are second order equations, which is why they even exist as different equations in the first place, and you can swap them with some duality. So the idea was that if you go to a first order formulation, well, these equations are not here anymore because it's first order now, but instead you have two sets of equations. So maybe this duality is kind of already manifest once you are in the first order formulation. And maybe you can try to access kind of all the charge content of the theory because this, kind of you have access to more gauge transformations. So the idea is to try to go to first order formulation. And then the hope was that from the first order formulation, so again, even though on shell it's equivalent to the initial theory you're trying to describe, maybe at the level of the charges, there is a procedure which, through which some of the boundary charges actually survive and describe something meaningful. And again, this is just a motivation because then I want to describe what should happen in the case of gravity. So this is just a hand-waving motivation coming from last year. But what happens if we do this for Maxwell is that we can write Maxwell in first order form. So by taking something which is topological, namely a BF theory. So BF theory has some D minus 2 form here. And F is, as usual, the curvature of a one form. So this by itself is topological, but then if you add this extra term, star B wedge B, then the equations of motion, the first one is that dB is equal to zero. This is by varying the connection. And by varying the B field, we get that B is equal to star F. So together, these equations imply Maxwell's equations. B star F equals zero. But now if we mimic, for example, what is done in the SSSJ paper, and if we first focus on the BF part, look at the charges and then go on shell, we see that there's maybe a mechanism through which part of the charges can survive, and we can interpret these as the magnetic charges. And so this mechanism is by first focusing on the BF theory. And as we know, BF theory has two types of symmetries. The first one is already present in Maxwell, and that's just U1 gauge transformations. So it's changing the gauge field by the alpha, and it's not acting on the B field because it's abelian. So for abelian BF, these things don't act on the B field. But because it's BF, there is also a second set of symmetries, which are usually called the shift symmetries, and these don't act on the gauge field, but they transform the B field by d phi, where here in four dimensions, importantly, phi is a one form. And now by just looking at the, so since we have these two symmetries now, we can use whatever formalism we prefer, either Hamiltonian or covariant phase space, or do the extension like Laurent and William propose. But at the end of the day, we can look at the Hamiltonian charges for these gauge transformations. And then we find that Lorentz transformations have a charge given by alpha B, and the shifts have a charge given by integral of phi A. And if you compute the Poisson bracket between these charges, this is just a property inherited from BF theory. We find that the algebra has a central extension, and here there is no Q term because it's abelian, so there's no commutator of alpha and phi, but we just find the central extension, which is phi wedge d alpha. And so this is the usual well-known central or current algebra, abelian current algebra of BF theory. But now the point, or rather the jump, is to say that this is just BF theory, it's not Maxwell theory. If you want to go from this to Maxwell theory, we have to impose the equations of motion. So on shell, essentially two things happen. The first one is straightforward, is that the charge for Lorentz transformations, so the Q alpha becomes the electric charge. This becomes alpha star F. That's the first thing. And now the other step is that if we go on shell, and if we go from BF to Maxwell theory,
So the shift symmetry is only for BF.
Yeah, the shift symmetry is only for BF, yes. Okay. But now with this idea that I would like the first order theory to have more symmetries than its second order version, I would like going from the first order theory to the second order theory to, in a sense, preserve some of the charges of the first order theory. And there is a way to do this here. I will do it a bit the most straightforward way is to do it brute force, but this can be formalized because in the case of four-dimensional BF theory, this shift symmetry has the property of being reducible, meaning that it has a kernel. So this is actually zero if phi itself is d of something, is d of phi tilde. And it's known for a long time how to deal with reducible gauge transformations. For example, in BRST formalism. So here, what we would like to do is, as Bianca said, this symmetry is only a symmetry of BF theory, not of Maxwell theory. So if we go on shell, in Maxwell theory, we don't want to preserve this theory. So there is no canonical generator of this in the bulk because this symmetry does not exist in Maxwell. But we could say that if we want to kill this shift symmetry, the proper way to kill it is not to just take phi to be constant, because precisely because this symmetry is reducible, the way to kill it is to take phi to be d of some phi tilde. So we take phi to be d of phi tilde, and this is sufficient to kill this shift symmetry. And by doing so, this shift charge of BF theory becomes like the analog of a magnetic charge for Maxwell theory. This becomes d phi tilde, which A. And then this current algebra of electric and magnetic charges of Maxwell theory, which was again derived by Strominger and then re-derived by in these two papers, one can also induce it from this central extension of BF theory. So then we get this thing, so that the electric and magnetic algebra becomes, M becomes integral of d phi tilde d alpha. Which is a bit strange because it has two derivatives, but in electromagnetism, in Maxwell theory, this is the only way we can actually create a central extension because you see, this quantity is not zero only if either gauge parameter, phi or alpha, has a cut, is not single valued. And then even integrating this by part would not give a zero result. So in this picture, I don't know for the moment if this makes so much sense, but this would kind of mean that this the analog of this magnetic soft mode is kind of the reducible part of the shift symmetry of BF theory, once we go from the first order formulation to the second order formulation. And what is nice is that this argument also extends to other theories and other dimensions. For example, if you look at 3D Maxwell instead, because this was four-dimensional Maxwell, if you look at 3D Maxwell, in 3D Maxwell, we know that there is only electric charge because the duality changes the form degree. And so we cannot construct a magnetic charge in 3D Maxwell. And if we try to reproduce this argument, the first order version of 3D Maxwell is also a BF theory plus this constraint, but now it's a 3D BF theory. So BF now is not a two form, but it's a one form. And if BF, if the B field is a one form, this phi is a zero form, and then this gauge symmetry is not reducible anymore. And then the only way to kill, to disallow this gauge transformation is to take phi to be constant. And therefore, this equivalent of these magnetic charges don't survive because phi has to be constant. And then consistently, we find that 3D Maxwell has no magnetic, cannot have a magnetic charge.
So when you say these aren't single valued, then they're discontinuous, or do they have poles in them? Like, what are they as functions on the sphere? Or do you want poles in them?
Yes, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Which is what happens in Strominger's story.
Okay.
That's why this thing exists in the first place. And now also, if we go back to the 4D scalar, so the duality that was proposed by, studied by Laurent and there was also Florian and Ronaxoni and Miguel Campiglia. Well, then the 4D scalar, the way they describe its asymptotic charge is by dualizing it and writing it as a two-form gauge theory. Now this is dual to some star f, which f, but now f is a three-form because it's the curvature of a two-form gauge potential. So star f is a one-form. So you can also write this as a BF theory plus constraint. Now the question I want to ask is how we know in this formulation that there is not yet another set of charge that is kind of forgotten, because we say that the scalar has some conserved charges. You can reveal this charge by going to this gauge formulation. But if this gauge formulation, through this argument here, maybe has two sets of dual charges, how do we know that in the first place the 4D scalar does not have more sets of charges? And if we follow this set of dualities, we now write this in first order formulation. It's also a BF theory, but now yet a different type of BF theory, because now it's a 4D BF theory in which the B is a one form again, and the F is a three form, even though it's in four dimensions. So by the same argument on the form degree of this phi, now we find again consistently that this does not have a magnetic version of the charges. Therefore, this does not have either, and therefore the 4D scalar only has the charge that was described in the first place. So this was just to, so 2 points here to conclude this was just to say that we kind of learned something about charges which can potentially distinguish, so charges which by definition are supported on the boundary and which potentially can distinguish two theories which are equivalent on shell in the bulk. And so maybe, I don't know if this type of first order, going to first order, I don't know if this can be used as some kind of organizing principle to probe these dualities and the existence of these charges. This I don't know. But at least it shows that even if two theories are equivalent in the bulk, they can differ on the boundary. And this brings me to the second part now, which is to discuss this in gravity. And this is where it's important for maybe for many people in the room, because typically in loop quantum gravity, what we do is that we consider a first order formulation of general relativity. And recently there was precisely some discussion about whether when we go to first order formulation, something kind of similar appears. You allow new set of symmetries and new charges, and it's not clear whether these charges should be, you should keep them or do everything you can to get rid of these charges. So this would suggest that you should keep these charges, and I want to use this argument to also keep the charges in gravity. So in gravity, what would happen? So first order GR. So as you know very well, we go, instead of working with a metric Lagrangian, which is this, we work with a first order Lagrangian, so E wedge omega, which is this plus, so this is the usual Hilbert-Palatini action, and typically in loop quantum gravity, we add this topological term, which has this free parameter, and this free parameter is very important because it controls essentially the discreteness of the area. And you will see that here, this parameter beta plays also a kind of surprising role, which has to do with this discreteness of area. So we know that these theories are equivalent on shell, but they're not equivalent at the boundary. And there's actually already a straightforward way to see that they're not equivalent at the boundary, which is precisely the source of this kind of recent disagreements. And the way to see this is to just look at the symplectic potential of these two theories, because the symplectic potential is the...
You mean GR metric and, okay.
Yeah. Because the symplectic potential is the object you start with to construct all these covariant phase space structures, so it's the zeroth order thing you can look at. And if you look at the metric potential, so, okay, never mind, but you remember this as this kind of ugly expression, G alpha beta at mu delta G alpha beta, okay. It's actually much simpler in tetrad variables, because in tetrad this is, yeah, so what I will do later is a bit call this thing just B wedge F, but this is not BF as a topological theory, it's BF where B is actually this combination of the E fields. For simplicity, I call it B, because then the potential just takes this form. It takes the form B wedge delta omega. So it's much simpler to derive this. There's only one integration by parts to do in this Lagrangian, and you get B wedge delta omega. And then the first kind of surprising thing to observe is that if you, as we know, these two theories are equivalent on shell, so you could ask, are the potentials equivalent on shell? And then if you go on shell, you can see that they're not equivalent. So it's not equal to a theta metric. And by on shell, this on shell means when omega is the spin connection, so omega of E. And they're not equal, but importantly, they're not equal up to something, which is just the total derivative. So they're not equal, or we could say they are equal plus D of something. And precisely because they differ by a total derivative, then if we use this to then construct covariant phase space quantities, the symplectic structure will be shifted by a boundary term. And because of this, necessarily all the charges that we compute will not be the same in the two theories because they differ by surface integrals. And it's just because of this equality here.
But is that a question? Is the change of variable is which side you put the D? If you start from the action with the D somewhere else, you also vary theta or not?
You want to start with an action that has a D here?
If you put a boundary Lagrangian, you don't change theta.
Well,
if you have the same variables, but you change the action by integrating something by part, also change theta or not?
It actually depends. It depends. So it depends which version of the covariant phase space you do. I will discuss this in a minute.
So
I think the answer is yes.
Yes, yes. So could you start from the E omega thing and then integrate by part and get theta metric instead of theta theta?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I will show you in a minute.
Okay, good.
It depends what you want to construct. Yeah. Precisely because it can be that for the computation of some charges, this is actually kind of degenerate. You can make different choices of this D that give you still this equivalence. And some of these Ds you can obtain from boundary Lagrangian, and some you cannot. That's the point.
So that there's more information into the first order, right? So there's things you cannot write with a metric that you can write.
Yeah,
there's
this
more
is.
That affects the boundary charges.
So now a typical example of where they differ. So as the potentials differ by a boundary term, the charges will be different. And a typical example of how the charges differ is if you compute so in the metric formulation, the Diffeo charge. So this is denoted Q psi for a Diffeo. So I just take this potential here and I compute, use these usual covariant phase space formulas or just the Noether charge. This will be something called the Komar charge. And this is essentially the integral of rd xi, or in components, it's epsilon mu nu rd nu psi nu. But this is the binormal to this codimension 2 surface. So that's the usual metric charge that you get. But if you go to tetrad variables, the Diffeo charge doesn't look like this at all, but it's something actually linear in the vector field. So it's psi contracted with B wedge omega.
And B is still EYG.
Yeah, and B is still this combination of E's, yes. And then again, for the same reason as here, even if you go on shell, and even if you write omega as omega of E, this will not be the Komar charge.
Unless there's a killing field. Unless it's a killing field.
Unless actually psi is a killing vector field. Yeah. Then this gives the Komar charge. But you want this equality to be true in general.
So the question?
Yeah.
And the cha-cha formalism, you have the emergency parameter.
Yeah.
So as long as it depends on the emergency parameter, which the metric version doesn't depend on, it can't possibly.
Yeah.
There could most be one value of the emergency parameter for which they were equal.
And actually, this will not give this regardless of the value of the emergency parameter.
So the same value of the emergency parameter.
You cannot fix this by choosing the emergency parameter. But you will see in a minute that there are objects you can construct which only exist if you have a non-zero emergency parameter. And this will.
The emergency parameter give you the topological Komar charge.
Well, I say yes, but it's the first time I hear that.
Yeah, even if you kind of.
Without the star, basically.
still generate a debit on the stock.
Yeah.
Is it related to this that when you're in the canonical formalism, what we usually call the vector constraint is not the degenerate diffeomorphism, but differs by an SU2?
No.
It's not related.
No, this I will also come back to in a minute. But at least, I mean, without doing any manipulations, adding things, if you just take either of these potentials, you take the metric one, you get this, the tetrad one, you get this, they will never be equal. And then, of course, because it's first order and you have these Lorentz indices, there are also charges which don't exist in the metric formulation. And these are the Lorentz charges, Q alpha. And these are just the integral of alpha b. Put some Lorentz indices, alpha ij, bij. So now one could be not satisfied with this result for two reasons. So the first one would be to say that, in fact, one can try to force these two theories to be equivalent even on the boundary, because they're equivalent in the bulk. One could try to say, let's fix this derivative here by using this ambiguity in the boundary term of the potential to actually make the theories equivalent even on the boundary. And if one does this, this will have two effects. This will have these two consequences. So this was done by, there's a proposal by De Paoli, Speziale, and actually, apparently Matthias Blau had also come up with this, this potential before. And this is just to consider a new potential, theta prime, tetrad, which is the old one, plus, well, precisely a total derivative, which is b ei delta ei, plus kind of a weird term, ijkl, ei wedge ej, alpha k, e alpha l. So this is this Emirzi term again. In fact, this beta term does not really play any role here. We could forget it altogether. The point is that you can put this term here, which is kind of strange because you see the only way to construct this term is to use the inverse tetrad. So you have to invert it here. And you know that, in fact, there is a crucial difference which you can never get rid of in tetrad variable is that even if you go on shell, tetrad is inequivalent to metric because tetrad allows for a priori for degenerate tetrads. And this you cannot enforce because the condition of degeneracy is not is an anholonomic constraint, and you cannot really do anything to, in terms of constraint algebra, to get rid of this condition. But here, as soon as you use the inverse tetrad, you kind of restrict yourself from removing these degenerate solutions to the tetrad variables. And then, as you will see, this does the job and gives you the metric results. So if you use this theta prime, then with this theta prime, you will get that the new charge for the diffeos is the comma charge. This is precisely the term which takes you from this tetrad diffeo charge to the comma charge, but at the price of actually killing this Lorentz charge here. You can do this. You can do it in such a way that this becomes the comma charge. And then you're happy because then it means that it's at the boundary equivalent in the sense of diffeos to the metric formulation. But the price to pay is that the Lorentz charges, they become, they are vanishing. And this is a bit strange because it doesn't really fit with loop quantum gravity in a sense. Because in loop quantum gravity, kind of everything is constructed from these Lorentz charges, or at least in the gauge fixed version, the SU2, not the full SL2C charges, but the SU2 charges. For example, it's these charges that the computation of black hole entropy in LQG is counting. If you set these charges to zero, it's not really clear what.
In other words, those are the punctures.
Yes.
If you set those to zero, you can't have any edges that go to infinity or go to finite.
Yes.
The spin of the network is the value of this charge.
And is the mass also zero?
The mass, no. It's in comma.
So from the pure GR classical phase space picture, you can do this, of course. You're always free to use this ambiguity. But then you're actually changing the theory, because as we saw now, even if they're equivalent on shell, you can decide if you make them equivalent on the boundary or not. And making them equivalent or not on the boundary actually changes then the physical content of the theory.
Can I ask a quick question?
So, yeah.
Why were you even talking about the Komar charge? Because this thing, it's only like non-zero. It's only the charge if the vector is vanishing at the surface, right?
So, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So I just got confused why you're trying to make this thing the Komar charge or something when.
So I'm not exactly. Yeah, thanks. So I'm not trying to make it, or they were not trying to make it the Komar charge, but I think they were just. So by doing this, you're not saying that the Komar charge is a more fundamental charge than any other Diffeo charge. I think you're just kind of comparing things that, I mean, you have to know what you want to match on both sides of the theory, right? I think this is just a way of saying you want this to match something. One way to match something which is known is to match this to the Komar charge, and then this becomes zero. In fact, in a minute, I will show how to match this to not the Komar charge, but to the Brown-York charge, which is what actually shows up in the Hamiltonian formulation. That's the boundary term of the vector constraint. So instead, what one can do, and what we're trying to do with Laurent and Daniele, was to, instead of getting rid of this contribution on the boundary by adjusting the corner term, you can actually zoom in a bit on the symplectic potential of tetrad gravity and try to analyze a bit more the structure. And if you analyze this, you will see that, so in the first place, there is something a bit confusing just working with the B and omega, is that, as I wrote before, in tetrad, the theta, I just wrote B watch delta omega, even if B was secretly this. Even if you write this, it is a bit confusing because, so we know that the symplectic potential gives you the symplectic structure once you integrate it on a slice. So it tells you which variable is canonically conjugate to which variable. And this is not encoded in here because actually the tetrad formulation of gravity has lots of what is called second class constraints, meaning that if you do this, you don't immediately get access to which variable is canonically conjugated to which. And this is a bit non-standard because in most, for any other theory in which typically the covariant phase space is used, it's always theory without second class constraints. So typically QED or Trans-Siemens or BF or metric gravity. None of these theories have second class constraints. But this has second class constraints, meaning that not all these components of E are conjugated to all these components of omega. And so the way to kind of decipher this is to properly decompose the potential on a slice. And if you properly decompose the potential, you will get that the symplectic structure takes this form. Now there is also a boundary term, delta EI delta NI plus EI. And so in this decomposition, so what are these objects? So I've introduced new objects here. So this E is essentially this, E wedge E, IJ, that you put a normal. So this E is the usual flux of loop quantum gravity, except that here it's written with a covariant Lorentz index. This is the usual 1/2 epsilon epsilon EE. It's just this star E wedge E, but contracted with the normal. N is just the normal to a slice, but now written in with an internal index. In this way, so that's the usual ADM type normal to the slice. That's E. And this object K, which is here, K is actually the covariant derivative of this N. K is D by the connection of N. And to get this, you actually, the last thing I write is you have to decompose the connection in this form, gamma plus anti-symmetrized Kj, Kj. And what this means, actually, this. Sorry?
No,
emergency is here. Yeah.
Okay.
And why you have to use these variables? Because these are precisely the combination of variables which solve this second class constraint. So saying that here, these are way too many variables. Here there are 36 B variables and lots of omega variables. Yeah, 6 times 4, yes. And this is because B does not have actually this form. B is written in terms of E. So that's solving these second class conditions on the B field. But there are also constraints on omega. And the constraints on omega are solved by saying this. And this is not innocent because since omega is a connection, if you decompose a connection, it's not, right? If you write a connection as a connection plus a vector, it's non-trivial information because this is an affine space. And so in this decomposition, this gamma is such that this preserves the normal. And actually on shell of the torsion, this becomes the Levi-Civita connection of this E field. So d gamma of E on shell is equal to 0. So this is the proper decomposition that solves the constraints. And then you get this. And then indeed, you get here 12 plus 12 variables. This is 24. And then you have 6 Lorentz transformations, 4 diffeomorphisms, which takes you to 4 phase space degrees of freedom. So that's the correct parametrization of this phase space. And you see that here, what appears is that you have a bulk piece. And then you have something on the boundary, which appears naturally. On the boundary, you have this E field conjugated to the normal. And the only contribution of the Emirdzi parameter is this boundary term. And this is something which is known for a long time, right? That you can, the Ashtekar-Barbero connection, the Emirdzi piece of the connection, you can actually write it as a boundary term. And this, here I have chosen to write it completely as a boundary term. You could also take it and write it in the bulk, conjugated to E. But here it's just on the boundary.
Is that the no commutativity of
the fluxes on
to try it with itself?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And just this to clarify what this means in metric terms, this is the usual metric potential. This delta EI, if you write this back in tetrads, and this is just delta PAB, delta QAB, the spatial metric and the conjugate momentum. OK, another question you can ask with this is, so now you don't want to kill all these Lorentz charges. You want to keep these Lorentz charges. So are we not adding a corner term to remove this contribution of the boundary symplectic structure? If you did this using a corner term like Simone and Elena, you would get 0 Lorentz charges. If you don't do this, you keep this boundary symplectic structure. And now what you also get out of this boundary symplectic structure is you can ask about the Poisson bracket of the boundary metric. And to get the Poisson bracket of the boundary metric, it's convenient to use, so I do just the last change of variables, introduce this nij. Just this, basically. So this E tilde is the spatial E, the frame field on the slice. You take the normal, you anti-symmetrize. And with this, you can actually rewrite the boundary symplectic structure. And then it takes a very simple form. It's star plus beta delta n ij, which delta n ij. And then out of this, if you look at the boundary metric, so the boundary metric GAB is Nij symmetrized Eij. And then from this, because you know the boundary symplectic structure, you know how these variables commute, their commutation relations on the boundary. And if you use this to compute the Poisson brackets of this boundary metric, you will find that it satisfies an SL2R algebra on the two-dimensional boundary. But what is surprising is that so you compute the Poisson bracket. On the right-hand side, you find the SL2R commutation relations, but it's all proportional to beta. So the fact that you have beta non-zero is translated here directly in the fact that this boundary metric is non-commuting and has an SL2R algebra.
Boundary has punctures in it, do you get the
Well, that's what we would like to construct, actually. But, yeah, so not so far, but presumably. Yes. Hopefully, yes.
And this is the tangent metric, right? It's not the metric that we usually deal with in blue gravity.
Yeah, that's not the metric. It's just the metric tangent to the two sphere. Mm-hmm. And it's proportional to this parameter. So here you see that if you, so two things, that the even again, if the theories are equivalent on shell in the bulk, on the boundary, they have completely different charge structure. And even more, this term, which is completely topological and plays no role in the bulk, on the boundary gives you even extra structure, which even differentiates between the term without this topological piece and with this topological piece. It's surprising to get kind of an observable which is proportional to this quantity beta.
There's only one copy of SL2R. It's not like the conformal group on the sphere. It's just it's an SL2R, not like an SL2C.
Yeah, it's not an SL2C, but it's a.
I was just asking, yeah, if there's a conformal group.
Yeah, there is this SL2C. I mean, there's.
You haven't described the SL2C.
Yeah, but there's a. There is an SL2C, but it's the same as before. It's the SL2C for the Lorentz charges.
No, but you haven't written it in terms of n.
Yeah, but.
Are you getting part of like the Virasoro algebra acting on the sphere, or really the conformal group?
No, not so far. Yeah.
So if you just get one SL2R, it's like a chiral version of that.
Yeah, not so far. So far there is only this. There are the diffeos, and there is this the SL2C. Which is just these Lorentz charges, but which now you can, if you keep B, then it's obvious if you compute the Poisson bracket that this is the SL2C algebra, just because it's like in Maxwell or in, except that now you can, of course, write everything in terms of this new parametrization with this, right? You can replace the B by either C and N, or you can use this N, which is here. You can use which parametrization you choose. And then with any of this parametrization, you can check that the algebra of these charges is SL2C. So you get the SL2C, which was here in the beginning, and which you don't get rid of here because you don't put the boundary term that the corner term of Elena and Simone, which gets rid of this SL2C. Okay. Yeah, so now to. Okay. So this was kind of to illustrate how the first order theory has, kind of can have a richer structure than the metric theory. Then you're still free to decide whether you want to keep this extra structure or not, but I would say it's important to keep the extra structure. At least to understand what role it plays. And now I go back to the question by Carlo about the boundary action and what you can do by putting things on the boundary. Because this was to connect to the last part of the talk. I don't know if I will have time. So the boundary action, what you can do is consider a bulk plus boundary. So take again this BF where B is this combination of E fields in the bulk. And on the boundaries, there is a natural boundary term to put, which is beta EI, that's just E wedge to torsion, and then minus star E wedge EIJ wedge D omega SISJ. So this is like the Gibbons-Hawking term. And this one is zero on shell.
And what about the transignment?
Maybe you could put more stuff, yeah.
That would be the magnetic ledge modes.
Yeah.
It's just electric.
These are electric.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. But it's possible.
Yeah, you can add them. Yeah.
But there is, you can, yeah. Electric and magnetic are conjugate to each other, so you have to make a choice. They exclude each other. There's a central charge. There's an anomaly. That's why monopoles don't exist.
So that's kind of a natural boundary term to put here. And it appeared, so part of this appeared, was used by Obukov, I think, and also by Wolfgang Wieland a lot also. So this is a completely covariant boundary term. So it's the analog of Gibbons Hawking plus this beta piece, which is just the torsion, so zero on shell.
Who is Y?
York. He belongs here, right? And so yeah, the reason I wanted to mention this is to write the analog of, maybe it's a bit disconnected from that I was saying before, but the analog of this was this covariant phase space construction of Harlow and Wu, which manages to change the charges for diffeomorphism by putting a boundary Lagrangian and to do something a bit non-standard with the variational principle. So typically what happens here, if you compute the variation, if I just write this schematically, you vary the full action, in the bulk you have equations of motion. But on the boundary, you have, so the potential coming from the bulk gives you theta on the boundary, but then you also vary the boundary Lagrangian, but you don't view the boundary Lagrangian as a fixed variation. You actually compute explicitly the variation of the boundary Lagrangian, so you hit on all the terms, and in particular, because you have derivatives here, you will have to integrate by parts, and it will give you also a potential. If you first just write this, now you can write this explicitly now. So essentially this contains a boundary potential. Call it a var theta like this. And then the construction of Harlow is essentially to say that, so there is a very natural thing to say, is to say that when you define a theory by a bulk and a boundary Lagrangian, you have to take into account the fact that on the boundary you have derivatives. So the boundary Lagrangian also has a symplectic potential and a symplectic structure, and you have to properly glue the symplectic structures from the bulk and from the boundary. And this is the total symplectic structure of the theory. And this is a natural way to get boundary contributions to the bulk symplectic structure, because you put something on the boundary. So this was made formal last summer in a paper by Harlow and Wu. And if you do the same thing here, I don't reproduce the steps at all, because the only thing that is happening is that you say that the potential you should work with is not the initial one, but some kind of extended object. That's the initial potential. And there is an important minus sign here, minus the potential, this one, which is here. And I wrote what this is for. So in this case, so this theta here, in this case, so this is just the potential from the bulk, written with this decomposition from before, but schematically it's this. And now the boundary piece coming from this boundary Lagrangian is just, okay, maybe it doesn't matter, maybe to write it. EI is just the derivatives which are here. There is one here, so E wedge delta E, and also here with the variation of the normal. So minus 2 delta SI SJ. And now if you work with this potential here, so the first comment is that this is a bit more natural because, in fact, the potential which was used by Simone and Elena, you see that the beta piece is the same, but the second piece is not the same. And because this potential here has the inverse tetrad, it's very awkward to write a Lagrangian which gives you this potential here. It would even be impossible, actually, to find an, if you try to integrate this to write a Lagrangian whose variation gives you this potential, it will not work. But there is a natural boundary term, which is just the first order analog of Gibbons Hawking, and it's this piece here. And then it gives you this potential. And if you do this, basically the charge that you get for Now you get the same result as Harlow. The charge that you get for diffeomorphisms is the Brown-Yorke charge. And this is just the integral of, in first order terms, you get this, ijkl psi j. Okay, it's a bit annoying, but. And if you write this back in metric quantities, this is just the determinant and the normal and alpha psi beta and the momentum here. And this is the Brown-Yorke charge. Okay, so this was just to give the first order analog of this construction by Harlow, which gets the Brown-Yorke charge from this kind of modified variational principle. Modified in the sense that you don't just take the bulk symplectic structure, but you take the bulk symplectic structure and you add to it the symplectic structure coming from the boundary Lagrangian. And it's normal that you get the Brown-Yorke charge and not the Komar charge, because in the first place, I don't know if I erased it here. The bulk potential that you get, which I wrote before, this delta E wedge delta K, which is actually delta P delta Q, this is what gives you the Brown-Yorke charge. So the Brown-Yorke charge is the charge that appears in the Hamiltonian formulation, and it's not the Komar charge. Another way to see it is if you vary the diffeomorphism constraint. So the vector constraint is mirrored. It's just, what is it again? Psi alpha. Yes, this is psi. This is the generator of spatial diffeomorphisms. So this is the ADM momentum, PAB, and it's psi times the derivative of PAB. And if you vary this, if you vary this V, you get exactly the Lie derivative along psi of Q times delta P minus the Lie derivative of P times delta Q plus the variation of the Brown-Yorke charge. And this piece here is exactly what you would get by contracting a diffeomorphism, which this bulk symplectic structure here. So what you get naturally in the Hamiltonian formulation is the Brown-Yorke charge and not the Komar charge. And in this covariant phase-based language, the way to get the Brown-Yorke charge instead of the Komar charge is by using this boundary Lagrangian and then combining the bulk symplectic structure with the one from the boundary Lagrangian. Okay. I think I will stop. I just wanted to say a last thing, but it's a bit different. But so the why I wanted to say this was to motivate the fact that I think it's a bit new to do this procedure, which is what I meant by when I said extended actions, because it's this idea of defining a theory not just by the bulk Lagrangian and the bulk symplectic structure, but defining a theory by specifying a Lagrangian for potentially all the manifolds of lower dimensions. In this case, it's just stopped at the boundary, but maybe you can also put fields at the corners and up to codimension D. But then if you want to do this, you want this to be meaningfully kind of communicating. And if you do, for example, the original Wald's version of the covariant phase space, which I understood was the criticism by Harlow a bit, is that if you do this, no matter what you put on the boundary, if you view it as a total variation of the boundary Lagrangian, then the symplectic structure is insensitive to this, because to get the symplectic structure, you take a further delta, then you get delta square, which is zero. So this idea here of combining the bulk and the boundary symplectic potential is a way to naturally make this the boundary Lagrangian talk with the bulk Lagrangian. And then in the last part of the talk, I wanted just to explain how this can be used to build a covariant version, a Lagrangian version of this construction of Laurent and William, which is to extend the phase space by adding edge mods. And so I just wanted to say that by doing, now you can reverse the logic. In the construction of Laurent and William, you have a systematic procedure to add extra fields exactly in this corner ambiguity to make the full symplectic structure gauge invariant and to describe in a disentangled manner gauge transformations and boundary symmetries. Then you can naturally ask, is there a Lagrangian on the boundary which just through this procedure, by collecting its potential and combining it with the bulk potential, gives me this extended symplectic structure. And then from this boundary Lagrangian, then you could ask, what is the dynamics of these extra fields that you have added on the boundary? And this is what we did in December in a paper with Putarak, where we explained a bit how this works. So we just tested it on the example of Trans-Simons theory, where it's known what the boundary dynamics of these extra fields is. And then we try to construct the analog of this for Maxwell theory. And okay, but so the motivation was to use this, make these symplectic structures talk to each other so that you can have meaningfully fields living on the boundary that induce a boundary symplectic structure. And okay, I can tell you later if you're interested, but maybe I stop.
Thank you, Mark, for a very clear talk. Questions? Yeah.
So, if I remember correctly, in the paper by Hadlo, the point that he stresses in the, at the beginning is the importance of imposing boundary conditions for. So here, you're saying, oh, we have this Lagrange, this boundary Lagrange. But if I remember his motivation, was somewhat to fix some of the variations to have a theory with boundary conditions imposed naturally as equations of boundary equations of motion, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And but then I wonder whether there is actually, from this perspective at least, I don't know if here you're generalizing to something where you allow also these extra things to vary, but if there is actually a difference between this extended symplectic structure, which is maybe a symplectic structure at fixed boundary conditions, and something like the one above, which is a different type of modification, which doesn't require fixing boundary conditions. So I have my own perspective on that first symplectic structure, which also explains why you cannot have it as a variation attribute.
Yeah, yeah.
Something because it contains a connection which has curvature, so it's not really exact.
Yeah.
So you cannot have it as a delta or something. But yeah, that's kind of.
Yeah, thanks. So I think there is exactly this distinction to be made. And this precisely also why this proposal up here, I don't really know what to do with it, because you're by doing this, you add this corner term, so you modify the charges. But you can do this without saying what you do to the variational principle, right? Without saying what you do to the boundary conditions. And I find it unnatural that without having to discuss what you do to the boundary conditions, you can change what the charges are. And because then you don't know what the rule of the game is, and you don't know what you have to decide and what you can freely choose. Here, at least, with this equation here, then this is just exactly the first order analog of what Harlow wrote. So it satisfies the same requirements. And then this is a natural corner term to put because it comes from this boundary Lagrangian, which does the same thing as in metric variables. It gives a well-defined variational principle for fixing E. Whereas if you don't put this boundary term, you have to fix the connection, so like fixing derivatives of the metric. And then the third layer, maybe what you mentioned, is that if you do, now in general, the thing I didn't talk about, induce this boundary symplectic structure from boundary Lagrangians in which you have added even more fields, which are not even present in the beginning, which is what we did in the paper with Putarak, then you allow yourself a lot of freedom because then in the analog of this, once you compute this variation and collect the corner term, what plays the role of the boundary condition can be a condition involving the new fields that you have added. So because now it's a condition on new fields that you have added, you're kind of free to fix anything you want because you just use these auxiliary fields to gain any.
So I agree with I understand and agree. So for me, the I would say rather than the first one is useless or unclear what it does, I think they serve different purposes. So this one is a complete, the second one, the one with the extra boundary term, is useful if you know which boundary conditions you want to impose, and it gives you all you want to know in full detail. While the previous one, I think, is useful if you want to do an analysis without imposing boundary conditions of, yeah, this would take a bit of a tangent, but which degrees of freedom are localized inside the region, which are not, and which super selection sector you can expect if you focus on observables contained in the region. So I think they both are useful. They just serve slightly different purposes.
Yeah, I totally agree, yeah.
I find very nice also this.
Yeah, I agree, thanks.
It's very general and sort of connects to what was what you present is very clean, very beautiful, very nice, and puts a lot of things in order for me also, which I'm a bit outside this game. But at the end of the day, what is it telling us about physics, nature, observability, gravity, whatever? At the end of the day, in the best possible world, what is it going to be used for?
Well, short answer is I don't...
How are you to be optimistic as much as you want?
No, short answer is I don't really know, but... Because I think, at least for me, the full picture is missing, because we're just collecting examples. One is in gravity, one is in Maxwell, one is in, for me, in transimons, and then I don't see I still fail to see a big organizing principle here. I think one reason why we cannot maybe discuss more for the moment is that we don't have at least a full picture of what all the algebra of all the charges is, for example. Because here, for example, I did not discuss.
So
you could think of this as the algebra of the boundary symmetries of your system, and then you could try to quantize this algebra, for example, just like we do in LQG, that everything is based on representations of SU2, for example.
The main motivation is what are the quantum degrees of freedom? So, for instance, one question is, do the flux commute or not? So, in metric gravity, yes, they do commute. Therefore, they don't carry a representation of SU2, they carry 0 degrees of freedom. If beta is non-zero, they don't commute. So this is a different quantization. These are different degrees of freedom. So for instance, it explains why the flux do not commute. But the flux is only one charge among many. So it explains what are the microscopical quantum degrees of freedom you need to use. This is how you identify them. Maybe the thing which is clear to you, which is not clear to Carlo, is that the flux that he's used to is the boundary charge.
Oh, yeah, it's clear.
It's clear. So then...
No, that's why I'm saying, oh, great, now I see if you...
So I think
it changes
quantization, and it may explain why people... You know, there's a difference between metric gravity and first-order gravity. They don't have the same number of degrees of freedom. Maybe both exist, or one does not exist. And one has quantization of area, the other does not. So they are kind of they give you.
For instance, you can include the additional risk charges as well.
Right, but from what you're saying, it's just the first step out of 100. I mean, Is that meant to clarify what already exists in terms of quantum theory, or is it meant to suggest a new way of doing it?
Includes new charges which you don't.
So for the second, it's just the prequel.
If you get drastically new charges, yeah, you have to start from.
Not just pre. It's like the pre was loop gravity. Loop gravity is the pre. Now we understand how loop gravity is. Is embedded into something bigger that has much more degrees of freedom and much more charge. And you know, a theory that contains the frame field, not just the flux and the connection, the tangential metric. So we're getting deeper into what is the quantum geometric observable. So the pre is what we were at for 20 years. Now we are in the pre.
Yeah, but then the question is maybe how long is from this arrival point? I see a lot of clarity, but how long is from arrival point to actually a quantum theory with extra variables exist?
Well,
is,
you could,
it's huge or is it small?
I would say no idea, but.
Okay. You are my it could be very close. According to these things, first you identify the boundary algebra of observable. And this is going to be done. It's not fully done. The full one, because there's electric magnetic. Two, you quantize it. Three, you're done. So if you find a representation of the full symmetry algebra on the two spheres, you are done.
Yeah, but Laurent, no, but
you have the full quantization in gravity in a local setting. You know, maybe not formulated as you want, but so it, you know. So finding the general, so understanding the quantization of this current algebra on the two sphere, now it's a very precise mathematical problem.
But that's too optimistic.
I don't think it is, because nobody has really first, you know, I mean, we are looking for the first time at quantization of loop algebra on the two sphere. There is, how many people? There is three. So, no, the you know, there's very few. Nobody has really looked at that.
Yeah, but for things like...
So maybe I'm optimistic, but it's completely, no, it is a completely new stuff.
But for the dynamics of LQG, for example?
What?
For the dynamics of the theory, for example, then it's not...
No, if you have the full asymmetry algebra, you have the dynamics, because the consistency, the fact that this algebra commutes, the fact that you have an algebra with closes is the dynamical content of the theory.
Yeah, but then you have to rephrase what you mean by dynamics, right?
Yeah, and we know, yes, sure. I mean, it's a conceptual rehashing that we know how to do in 2+1, or that we know how to, you know. So, yeah, I'm optimistic, but it's, I don't know. But it is a reset of the way of looking at it.
And also one thing, I mean, maybe I insisted too much on the LQG. I didn't mean to insist too much on the LQG aspect of this. I also wanted to talk about putting these things on the boundary, and I couldn't kind of finish and talk about this part. But at least this was also clarifying for me to kind of be able to, as I briefly mentioned, view this kind of trick to extending the phase space and having really hands-on access to these extra edge modes that you have added. And then ask, how does this fit with what is known, for example, in Schoen-Simons theory about the boundary dynamics, the contribution of these edge modes to entanglement entropy? And then we were trying with Poutarac to rephrase this thing in Maxwell theory, for example, and see. So at least here for us, it clarified the fact that.
That's very good.
Things which have been.
That's exactly my question. How much the aim of this is clarification?
Yeah.
How much is to. So it's a combination.
Yeah. So two things. I think maybe you should also maybe talk with Aldo because there's a lot that can be understood with the approach that he has with Enrique. And so here it's a very different point of view we take, maybe a bit more simple-minded, but at least for me it clarified the fact that, for example, the reason that people... So the first place in which boundary dynamics was discovered was in Schoen-Simons theory. And usually you find the statement that you have this boundary dynamics because the action is not gauge invariant, which is confusing because...
Yeah, because that's not point.
Yeah, the GR action is also not gauge invariant, for example. And and then from this point of view, you would think that then in Maxwell, there is no boundary dynamics because the action is gauge invariant. But then if you go through this thing of adding edge modes and if you forget a bit, even for a minute, about the meaning of this and whether you should add them or not, if you just do this and try to mimic step by step what you do in Schoen-Simons theory, then you find that through exactly the same mechanism, you get also a boundary action in Maxwell theory and a boundary dynamics and the contribution of this boundary path integral to observables like entanglement entropy. And it's more complicated to make sense out of this, but structurally it's a bit analogous.
But I think I sort of disagree about the fact that in Maxwell or Yang-Mills one actually needs these extra boundary degrees of freedom to make sense of the theory, let's say, with unfixed boundary conditions. If you want to fix them, then of course you have to add something that doesn't. And mathematically, the reason is that in Yang-Mills, the momenta, there is a gauge invariant version of the potential, of the symplectic potentials. And this is due to the fact that the momentum conjugate to the connection transforms in the adjoint representation, so it doesn't have an inhomogeneous term that kicks you on the bound. This is not the case for Jim Simons or the F theory, and it's not the case for gravity for different reasons. Now, the case of gravity is again special because, let's say, metric gravity, not vector. So, in metric gravity, what happens is that you need that extra term to have theta to be a density, so to transform covariantly under diffeo. So that extra term is actually necessary for the symmetry structure of the symplectic potential. And in that case, if you somewhat define your region relationally, it also would move together with the diffeos. And in a sense, the integrated object is invariant again. So I'm not sure what the result is for GR, but for I see a neat difference between Maxwell theory and Jim Simons theory, or BF. And so, yeah, that's just
okay.
Just to conclude, even in BV theories, so in this BV setting, which is like a GRSD on steroids, they have kind of they're trying to understand holography in Jim Simons theories in a very algebraic manner. And what they see, for example, is that these non-covariants of this, the analogous of these non-invariants of the symplectic potentials plays a role in their constructions, which, yeah, I don't know the mapping exactly, but there is this somewhat an analogy between.
Just one comment connecting to what Aldo was saying at the beginning. Let me tell you what I would love to see added here. This sounds like a good piece of the solution to a question. It's not really clear to me what is the question. What is the precise question? And of course, Morant says what is the question. Which is, well, what are the degrees of freedom? But that's not a precisely formulating question, right? It's a.
That's one question. The other one is how you
get the black hole.
Yeah. What is the entropy of a black hole?
What's the entropy of a black hole?
Yeah.
And basically, this is trying to account for that. So that's a precise question to try to answer with this.
Yeah, the other question would be, how do you couple matter?
Then he has to talk about that, right? So it's a long story between that and with the entropy of the black hole, we have 25 solutions in the literature. So
no, they can't.
Which one connects them? So there's a physical discussion, what we mean by entropy, in which sense is an entropy, what is, so I would like to see the connection, it's a very good point you're making. I would like to see the connection between, we call entropy, I don't know, dq over dt or k log, volume of phase space or whatever, anything. And there is a story which connects that thing, which has property of increase with time, to these things. What is this story? This piece of the story. Instead of, I do this to the action, I do this to the action, I do a lot of computation, look, I get A over 4. I would like that piece of the story, the physics, and the precise question we're asking. I'm not saying that this is not But I would like to see, that's why...
We're using it. What are the degrees of freedom is not a physical solution.
Things exist.
Sorry?
We're using it. What are the degrees of freedom of quantum gravity is not a physical solution.
No, no, it's a wonderful question, but it's a question that, you know, can be formulated in all sorts of different ways. ADM thought they answered.
No, but
and now we know why, you know, it's missing something. So that's because the energy in a box is zero in the dark. So the degrees of freedom are not, I mean, yeah. Another question is how do you couple, it's a question for LQG, how do you couple matter?
Yeah,
that's the thing. Is it matter here?
This has to do what really happens at boundary, what we mean by boundary. Is there a coupling there? There's a coupling with other system. How does other system couple? How is it related to the horizon? This is all what I think could or should or does and give a precise form of the question for which these could be pieces of the answer. That's my, I don't know, maybe I'm saying nonsense.
No, I think I agree. Although typically in 2 plus 1, even though we know a lot about this, like alleged boundary degrees of freedom and their dynamics, I think it's still not clear what is the entropy of the black hole, right? Maybe, I don't know.
It's still not clear even in 2D, that's why.
Because there's 48 versions of this boundary symmetries dynamics. You can write all sorts of things which give the same.
Yeah.
It's not clear which one you should actually.
But at least in 3D, the question of matrix, that is clear. That's that might be the more relevant question, maybe, that this approach could answer straightforwardly. OK. Thanks.